Bill for Leibowitz by Walter M. Miller, Jr. Continued. Cassette 7, Side 1. Then you were not wholly unaware that you were conditionally assigned to Quo Peregrinatur, if it ever came to pass? I guess I was afraid it was so, my lord.
Afraid?
Suspected, rather. Afraid, too, a little, because I've always hoped to spend the rest of my life in the Order.
As a priest?
That, well, I haven't yet decided.
Quo Peregrinatur will not involve releasing you from your vows, or mean abandoning the Order.
The Order goes, too?
Zerki smiled. And the memorabilia with it.
The whole kit and... Oh, you mean on microfilm. Where to?
The Centaurus colony.
How long would we be gone, Domne?
If you go, you'll never come back.
The monk breathed heavily and stared at the second telegram without seeming to see it. He scratched his beard and appeared bemused.
Three questions, said the abbot. Don't answer now, but start thinking about them, and think hard. First, are you willing to go? Second, do you have a vocation to the priesthood? Third, are you willing to lead the group? And by willing, I don't mean willing under obedience. I mean enthusiastic, or willing to get that way. Think it over. You have 3 days to think, maybe less.
Modern change had made but few incursions upon the buildings and the grounds of the ancient monastery. To protect the old buildings against the encroachment of a more impatient architecture, new additions had been made outside the walls, and even across the highway, sometimes at the expense of convenience. The old refectory had been condemned because of a buckling roof, and it was necessary to cross the highway in order to reach the new refectory. The inconvenience was somewhat mitigated by the culvert walk-under through which the brothers marched daily to meals. Centuries old, but recently widened, the highway was the same road used by pagan armies, pilgrims, peasants, donkey carts, nomads, wild horsemen out of the east, artillery, tanks, and 10-ton trucks. Its traffic had gushed, or trickled, or dripped, according to the age and season. Once before, long ago, there had been 6 lanes and robot traffic. Then the traffic had stopped, the paving had cracked, and sparse grass grew in the cracks after an occasional rain. Dust had covered it. Desert dwellers had dug up its broken concrete for the building of hovels and barricades. Erosion made it a desert trail, crossing wilderness. But now there were 6 lanes and robot traffic as before.
Traffic's light tonight, the abbot observed as they left the old main gate. Let's hike across. The tunnel can be suffocating after a dust storm. Or don't you feel like dodging buses?
Let's go, Brother Joshua agreed. Low-slung trucks with feeble headlights, useful only for warning purposes, sped mindlessly past them with whining tires and moaning turbines. With dish antennae, they watched the road, and with magnetic feelers, they felt at the guiding strips of steel in the roadbed and were given guidance thereby, as they rushed along the pink, fluorescent river of oiled concrete. Economic corpuscles in an artery of man, the behemoths charged heedlessly past the 2 monks, who dodged them from lane to lane. To be felled by one of them was to be run over by truck after truck until a safety cruiser found the flattened imprint of a man on the pavement and stopped to clean it up. The autopilot's sensing mechanisms were better at detecting masses of metal than masses of flesh and bone.
This was a mistake, Joshua said as they reached the center island and paused for breath. Look who's standing over there.
The abbot peered for a moment, then clapped his forehead.
Mrs. Grails, I clean forgot. It's her night to prowl me down. She sold her tomatoes to the sisters' refectory, and now she's after me again.
After you? She was there last night and the night before, too. I thought she was waiting for a ride. What does she want from you?
Oh, nothing, really. She's finished gypping the sisters on the price of tomatoes, and now she'll donate the surplus profit to me for the poor box. It's a little ritual. I don't mind the ritual. It's what comes afterward that's bad. You'll see.
Shall we go back?
And hurt her feelings? Nonsense. She's seen us by now. Come on.
They plunged into the thin stream of trucks again. The 2-headed woman and her 6-legged dog waited with an empty vegetable basket by the new gate. The woman crooned softly to the dog.
Four of the dog's legs were healthy legs, but an extra pair dangled uselessly at its sides. As for the woman, one head was as useless as the extra legs of the dog. It was a small head, a cherubic head, but it never opened its eyes. It gave no evidence of sharing in her breathing or her understanding. It lolled uselessly on one shoulder, blind, deaf, mute, and only vegetatively alive. Perhaps it lacked a brain, for it showed no sign of independent consciousness or personality. Her other face had aged, grown wrinkled, but the superfluous head retained the features of infancy, although it had been toughened by the gritty wind and darkened by the desert sun. The old woman curtsied at their approach, and her dog drew back with a snarl.
"Evening, Father Zerky," she drawled. "A most pleasant evening to yer, and to yer brother."
"Why, hello, Mrs. Grails." The dog barked, bristled, and began a frenzied dance, feinting toward the abbot's ankles, with fangs bared for slashing. Mrs. Grails promptly struck her pet with the vegetable basket. The dog's teeth slashed the basket. The dog turned on its mistress. Mrs. Grails kept it away with the basket, and after receiving a few resounding whacks, the dog retired to sit growling in the gateway.
"What a fine mood Priscilla's in," Zerky observed pleasantly. "Is she going to have pups?"
"Beg shriveness, your honors," said Mrs. Grails. "But 's not the pup's motherful condition as makes her so, devil fretter, but 'tis that man of mine. He's witched the piteous pup he has for love of witchin', and it makes her feared of all. I beg your honor's shriveness for her naughties."
"It's all right. Well, good night, Mrs. Grails." But escape proved not that easy. She caught at the abbot's sleeve and smiled her toothlessly irresistible smile.
"A minute, father, only a minute for an old tomato woman, if you have it to spare."
"Why, of course, I'd be glad." Joshua gave the abbot a sidelong grin and went over to negotiate with the dog concerning right-of-way. Priscilla eyed him with plain contempt.
"Here, father, here," Mrs. Grails was saying. "Take a little something for your box. Here."
Coins rattled while Zerky protested.
"No, here, take of it," she insisted. "Oh, I know as how ye always say, by fret, but I be not so poor as ye might think on me, and ye do good work. If ye don't take of it, that no good man of mine'll have it from me, and do him the devil's work. Here, I sold my tomatoes, and I got my price near, and I bought my feed for the week, and even a play pretty for Rachel. I want ye to have of it here."
"It's very kind."
"Grumph!" came an authoritative bark from the gateway. "Grumph! Ralph! Ralph! Ralph!"
followed by a rapid sequence of yaps, yeeps, and Priscilla's howling in full retreat. Joshua came wandering back with his hands in his sleeves.
"Are you wounded, man?"
"Grumph!" said the monk. "What on earth did you do to her?"
"Grumph!" Brother Joshua repeated. "Ralph! Ralph! Ralph!"
then explained. "Priscilla believes in werewolves. The yelping was hers. We can get past the gate now." The dog had vanished, but again Mrs. Grails caught at the abbot's sleeve.
"Only a minute more of your father, and I'll keep you no longer. It's little Rachel I wanted to see you about. There's the baptism and the christening to be thought of, and I wish to ask you if ye'd do the honor of—"
"Mrs. Grails," he put it gently, "go see your own parish priest. He should handle these matters, not I. I have no parish, only the abbey. Talk to Father Salo at St. Michael's. Our church doesn't even have a font. Women aren't permitted, except in the tribune."
"The sister's chapel has a font, and women can—"
"It's for Father Salo, not for me. It has to be recorded in your own parish. Only as an emergency could I—"
Aye, that I know, but I saw Father Salo. I brought Rachel to his church, and the fool of a man would not touch her."
"He refused to baptize Rachel?"
"That he did, the fool of a man."
"It's a priest you're talking of, Mrs. Grails, and no fool, for I know him well. He must have his reasons for refusing. If you don't agree with his reasons, then see someone else, but not a monastic priest. Talk to the pastor at St. Maisie's, perhaps."
"Aye, and that too have I done."
She launched into what promised to be a prolonged account of her skirmishings on behalf of the unbaptized Rachel. The monks listened patiently at first, but while Joshua was watching her, he seized the abbot's arm above the elbow. His fingers gradually dug into Zerki's arm, until the abbot winced in pain and tore the fingers away with his free hand.
"What are you doing?"
he whispered, but then noticed the monk's expression. Joshua's eyes were fixed on the old woman as if she were a cockatrice. Zerki followed his gaze, but saw nothing stranger than usual. Her extra head was half concealed by a sort of veil, but Brother Joshua had certainly seen that often enough.
"I'm sorry, Mrs. Grails," Zerki interrupted as soon as she fell short of breath. "I really must go now. I'll tell you what, I'll call Father Salo for you, but that's all I can do. We'll see you again, I'm sure."
"Thank you kindly, and beg your shriveness for keeping you."
"Good night, Mrs. Grails."
They entered the gate and walked toward the refectory. Joshua thumped the heel of his hand against his temple several times, as if to jar something back into place.
"Why were you staring at her like that?" the abbot demanded. "I thought it rude."
"Didn't you notice?"
"Notice what?"
"Then you didn't notice. Well, let it pass. But who is Rachel? Why won't they baptize the child? Is she the woman's daughter?"
The abbot smiled without humor. "That's what Mrs. Grails contends, but there's some question as to whether Rachel is her daughter, her sister, or merely an excrescence grown out of her shoulder."
"Rachel, her other head?"
"Don't shout so, she'll hear you."
"And she wants it baptized?"
"Rather urgently, wouldn't you say? It seems to be an obsession."
Joshua waved his arms. "How do they settle such things?"
"I don't know, and I don't want to know. I'm grateful to heaven that it's not up to me to figure it out. If it were a simple case of Siamese twins, it would be easy, but it isn't. The old-timers say Rachel wasn't there when Mrs. Grails was born."
"A farmer's fable."
"Perhaps. But some are willing to tell it under oath. How many souls has an old lady with an extra head? A head that just grew? Things like that cause ulcers in high places, my son. Now, what was it you noticed? Why were you staring at her and trying to pinch my arm off like that?"
The monk was slow to answer.
"It smiled at me," he said at last.
"What smiled?"
"Her extra, Rachel. She smiled. I thought she was going to wake up."
The abbot stopped him in the refectory's entranceway and peered at him curiously.
"She smiled," the monk repeated very earnestly. "You imagined it."
"Yes, my lord."
"Then look like you imagined it."
Brother Joshua tried.
"I can't," he admitted.
The abbot dropped the old woman's coins in the poor box.
"Let's go on inside," he said.
The new refectory was functional, chromium befixtured, acoustically tailored, and germicidally illuminated. Gone were the smoke-blackened stones, the tallow lamps, the wooden bowls, and cellar-ripened cheeses. Except for the cruciform seating arrangement and a rank of images along one wall, the place resembled an industrial lunchroom. Its atmosphere had changed, as had the atmosphere of the entire abbey. After ages of striving to preserve remnants of culture from a civilization long dead, the monks had watched the rise of a new and mightier civilization. The old tasks had been completed. New ones were found. The past was venerated and exhibited in glass cases, but it was no longer the present. The order conformed to the times, to an age of uranium and steel and flaring rocketry, amid the growl of heavy industry and the high, thin whine of star-drive converters. The order conformed, at least in superficial ways.
"Ac cedite ad eum," the reader intoned.
The robed legion stood restlessly at their places during the reading. No food had yet appeared. The tables were bare of dishes. Supper had been deferred. The organism, the community whose cells were men, whose life had flowed through 70 generations, seemed tense tonight, seemed to sense a note amiss tonight, seemed aware, through the connaturality of its membership, of what had been told to only a few. The organism lived as a body, worshipped and worked as a body, and at times seemed dimly conscious as a mind that infused its members and whispered to itself and to another in the lingua prima, baby tongue of the species. Perhaps the tension was increased as much by faint snort growl of practice rocketry from the distant anti-missile range as by the unexpected postponement of the meal. The abbot rapped for silence, then gestured his prior, Father Leahy, toward the lectern. The prior looked pained for a moment before speaking.
"We all regret the necessity," he said at last, "of sometimes disturbing the quiet of contemplative life with news from the outside world. But we must remember, too, that we are here to pray for the world and its salvation as for our own. Especially now, the world could use some praying for." He paused to glance at Zerki. The abbot nodded. "Lucifer is fallen," said the priest, and stopped. He stood there looking down at the lectern, as if suddenly struck dumb. Zerki arose.
"That is Brother Joshua's inference, by the way," he interposed. "The Regency Council of the Atlantic Confederacy has said nothing to speak of. The dynasty has issued no statements. We know little more than we knew yesterday, except that the World Court is meeting in emergency session, and that the Defense Interior people are moving fast. There is a defense alert, and we'll be affected, but don't be disturbed. Father?"
"Thank you, Domne," said the prior, seeming to regain his voice as Dom Zerki was seated again. "Now, Reverend Father Abbott asked me to make the following announcements. First, for the next 3 days we shall sing the Little Office of Our Lady before Matins, asking her intercession for peace. Second, general instructions for civil defense in the event of a space strike or missile attack alert are available on the table by the entrance. Everybody take one. If you've read it, read it again. Third, in the event that an attack warning is sounded, the following brothers are to report immediately to Old Abbey Courtyard for special instructions. If no attack warning comes, the same brothers will report there anyway, day after tomorrow morning, right after Matins and Lauds. Names? Brothers Joshua, Christopher, Augustine, James, Samuel." The monks listened with quiet tension, betraying no emotion. There were 27 names in all, but no novices were among them. Some were eminent scholars. There were a janitor and a cook as well. At first hearing, one might assume that the names had been drawn from a box. By the time Father Leahy had finished the last, some of the brothers were eyeing each other curiously. "And this same group will report to the dispensary for a complete physical examination tomorrow after prime," the prior finished. He turned to look questioningly at Dom Zerki. "Domne?"
"Yes, just one thing," said the abbot, approaching the lectern. "Brothers, let us not assume there is going to be war. Let's remind ourselves that Lucifer has been with us, this time, for nearly 2 centuries, and was dropped only twice, in sizes smaller than Megaton. We all know what could happen if there's war. The genetic festering is still with us from the last time man tried to eradicate himself. Back then, in the St. Leibowitz's time, maybe they didn't know what would happen, or perhaps they did know but could not quite believe it until they tried it. Like a child who knows what a loaded pistol is supposed to do, but who never pulled a trigger before. They had not yet seen a billion corpses. They had not seen the stillborn, the monstrous, the dehumanized, the blind. They had not yet seen the madness and the murder and the blotting out of reason. Then they did it, and then they saw it. Now the princes, the presidents, the presidiums, now they know, with dead certainty. They can know it by the children they beget and send to asylums for the deformed. They know it, and they've kept the peace. Not Christ's peace, certainly, but peace. Until lately. With only 2 warlike incidents in as many centuries. Now they have the bitter certainty. My sons, they cannot do it again. Only a race of madmen could do it again." He stopped speaking. Someone was smiling. It was only a small smile, but in the midst of a sea of grave faces, it stood out like a dead fly in a bowl of cream. Dom Zerki frowned. The old man kept on smiling wryly. He sat at the beggar's table, with 3 other transient tramps, an old fellow with a brushy beard, stained yellow about the chin. As a jacket, he wore a burlap bag with armholes. He continued to smile at Zerki. He looked old as a rain-worn crag, and a suitable candidate for a Maundy laving. Zerki wondered if he were about to stand up and make an announcement to his hosts, or blow a ram's horn at them, perhaps. But that was only an illusion generated by the smile. He quickly dismissed the feeling that he had seen the old man before, somewhere. He concluded his remarks. On his way back to his place, he paused. The beggar nodded pleasantly at his host. Zerki came nearer. "Who are you, if I may ask? Have I seen you somewhere before?"
"Laet Sarshami," What?
Lad Sarshami,
the beggar repeated. I don't quite.
Call me Lazarus, then,
said the old one, and chuckled. Dom Zerki shook his head and moved on. Lazarus. There was in the region an old wives' tale to the effect that... But what a shoddy sort of myth that was. Raised up by Christ, but still not a Christian, they said. And yet he could not escape the feeling that he had seen the old man somewhere. Let the bread be brought for blessing, he called, and the deferment of supper was at an end. After the prayers, the abbot glanced toward the beggar's table again. The old man was merely fanning his soup with a sort of basket hat. Zerki dismissed it with a shrug, and the meal began in solemn silence. Compline, the church's night prayer, seemed especially profound that night. But Joshua slept badly afterwards. In a dream, he met Mrs. Grails again. There was a surgeon who sharpened a knife, saying, "This deformity must be removed before it becomes malignant." And the Rachel face opened its eyes and tried to speak to Joshua, but he could hear her only faintly, and understand her not at all. "Accurate am I the exception," she seemed to be saying. "I commensurate the deception, am." He could make nothing of it. But he tried to reach through to save her. There seemed to be a rubbery wall of glass in the way. He pushed and tried to read her lips. I am the Immaculate Conception, came the dream whisper. He tried to tear his way through the rubbery glass to save her from the knife, but it was too late, and there was a great deal of blood afterwards. He awoke from the blasphemous nightmare with a shudder and prayed for a time, but as soon as he slept, there was Mrs. Grails again. It was a troubled night, a night that belonged to Lucifer. It was the night of the Atlantic assault against the Asian space installations. In swift retaliation, an ancient city died. Chapter 26 This is your emergency warning network, the announcer was saying when Joshua entered the abbot's study after matins the following day. Bringing you the latest bulletin on the pattern of fallout from the enemy missile assault on Texarkana. You sent for me, Domne? Zerki waved him to silence and toward a seat. The priest's face looked drawn and bloodless, a steel-gray mask of icy self-control. To Joshua, he seemed to have shrunk in size, to have aged since nightfall. They listened gloomily to the voice which waxed and waned at 4-second intervals, as the broadcasting stations were switched on and off the air, as an impediment to enemy direction-finding equipment. But first, an announcement just released by the Supreme Command. The royal family is safe. I repeat, the royal family is known to be safe. The Regency Council is said to have been absent from the city when the enemy struck. Outside of the disaster area, no civil disorders have been reported, and none is expected. A ceasefire order has been issued by the World Court of Nations, with a suspended proscription involving the death sentence against the responsible heads of government of both nations. Being suspended, the sentence becomes applicable only if the decree is disobeyed. Both governments cable to the court their immediate acknowledgement of the order, and there is, therefore, a strong probability that the clash is at an end, a few hours after it began, as a preventative assault against certain illegal space installations. In a surprise attack, the space forces of the Atlantic Confederacy last night struck at 3 concealed Asian missile sites located on the far side of the moon, and totally destroyed 1 enemy space station known to be involved in a guidance system for space-to-Earth missiles. It was expected that the enemy would retaliate against our forces in space, but the barbarous assault on our capital city was an act of desperation which no one anticipated. Special Bulletin. Our government has just announced its intention to honor the ceasefire for 10 days, if the enemy agrees to an immediate meeting of foreign ministers and military commanders on Guam. The enemy is expected to accept. 10 days, the abbot groaned. It doesn't give us enough time. The Asian radio, however, is still insisting that the recent thermonuclear disaster in Itaewon, causing some 80,000 casualties, was the work of an errant Atlantic missile, and the destruction of the city of Texarkana was therefore retaliation in kind. The abbot snapped off the set. Where's the truth? He asked quietly. What's to be believed, or does it matter at all?
When mass murder's been answered with mass murder, rape with rape, hate with hate, there's no longer much meaning in asking whose axe is the bloodier. Evil on evil piled on evil. Was there any justification in our police action in space? How can we know? Certainly there was no justification for what they did, or was there? We only know what that thing says, and that thing is a captive. The Asian radio has to say what will least displease its government. Ours has to say what will least displease our fine, patriotic, opinionated rabble. Which is what, coincidentally, the government wants it to say anyhow, so where's the difference? Dear God, there must be 500,000 dead if they hit Texarkana with the real thing. I feel like saying words I've never even heard. Toad's dung, hag pus, gangrene of the soul, immortal brain rot. Do you understand me, brother? And Christ breathed the same carrion air with us. How meek the majesty of our Almighty God. What an infinite sense of humor for him to become one of us, king of the universe, nailed on a cross as a Yiddish schlemiel by the likes of us. They say Lucifer was cast down for refusing to adore the incarnate word. The foul one must totally lack a sense of humor. God of Jacob, God even of Cain, why do they do it all again? Forgive me, I'm raving, he added, less to Joshua than to the old wood-carving of St. Leibowitz that stood in one corner of the study. He had paused in his pacing to glance up at the face of the image. The image was old, very old. Some earlier ruler of the abbey had sent it down to a basement storeroom to stand in dust and gloom, while a dry rot etched the wood, eating away the spring grain and leaving the summer grain, so that the face seemed deeply lined. The saint wore a slightly satiric smile. Zerki had rescued it from oblivion because of the smile.
"Did you see that old beggar in the refectory last night?" he asked irrelevantly, still peering curiously at the statue's smile.
"I didn't notice, Domne. Why?"
"Never mind. I guess I'm just imagining it."
He fingered the mound of faggots where the wooden martyr stood.
"That's where all of us are standing now," he thought. "On the fat kindling of past sins. And some of them are mine. Mine, Adam's, Herod's, Judas's, Hannigan's. Mine. Everybody's. Always culminates in the colossus of the state somehow, drawing about itself the mantle of godhood, being struck down by wrath of heaven. Why? We shouted it loudly enough. God's to be obeyed by nations as by men. Caesar's to be God's policeman, not his plenipotentiary successor, nor his heir. To all ages, all peoples. Whoever exalts a race or a state or a particular form of state or the depositories of power, whoever raises these nations above their standard value and divinizes them to an idolatrous level, distorts and perverts an order of the world planned and created by God. Where had that come from? 11th Pius, he thought, without certainty. 18 centuries ago. But when Caesar got the means to destroy the world, wasn't he already divinized? Only by the consent of the people, same rabble that shouted, "Non habemus regem nisi Caesarem," when confronted by him, God incarnate, mocked and spat upon, same rabble that martyred Leibowitz. Caesar's divinity is showing again. Domne? Let it pass. Are the brothers in the courtyard yet? About half of them were when I passed. Shall I go see? Do. Then come back here. I have something to say to you before we join them.
Before Joshua returned, the abbot had got the quo peregrinator papers out of the wall safe.
Read the precy, he told the monk. Look at the table of organization. Read the procedural outline. You'll have to study the rest in detail, but later.
The communicator buzzed loudly while Joshua was reading.
"Reverend Father Jethro Zerki, Abbas, please," droned the voice of a robot operator.
"Speaking.
Urgent priority wire from Sir Eric Cardinal Hopstraff, New Rome. There is no courier service at this hour. Shall I read?"
"Yes, read the text of it. I'll send someone down later to pick up a copy."
"The text is as follows. Grex peregrinus erit quam primum est factum scipiendum vobis, iussu sacte sedis, suscipite ergo aperis partem ordini vestro propriam.
Can you read that back in Southwest translation? The abbot asked.
The operator complied, but in neither did the message seem to contain anything unexpected. It was a confirmation of the plan, and a request for speed.
Receipt acknowledged, he said at last. Will there be a reply?
Reply as follows. Eminentissimo Domino Eric Cardinale Hofstraff, obsequitur Jethro Zerchius, Albertian Order of Leibowitz, Abbas. Ad has res disputandas iam cogi disceseros fratres ut hodie parati dimiti Roman prima eris nave possent. End of text.
I read back, eminentissimo.
All right, that's all, out. Joshua had finished reading the precis. He closed the portfolio and looked up slowly.
Are you ready to get nailed on it? Zerki asked.
I'm not sure I understand.
The monk's face was pale.
I asked you 3 questions yesterday. I need the answers now.
I'm willing to go.
That leaves 2 to be answered.
I'm not sure about the priesthood, Domne.
Look, you'll have to decide. You have less experience with starships than any of the others. None of the others is ordained. Someone has to be partially released from technical duties for pastoral and administrative duties. I told you this will not mean abandoning the Order. It won't. But your group will become an independent daughter house of the Order, under a modified rule. The Superior will be elected by secret ballot of the professed, of course, and you are the most obvious candidate, if you have a vocation to the priesthood as well. Have you or haven't you? There's your Inquisition and the times now, and a brief now it is, too.
But, Reverend Father, I'm not through studying.
That doesn't matter. Besides the 27-man crew, all our people, others are going too. 6 sisters and 20 children from the St. Joseph School, a couple of scientists and 3 bishops, 2 of them newly consecrated. They can ordain, and since one of the 3 is a delegate of the Holy Father, he will even have the power to consecrate bishops. They can ordain you when they feel you're ready. You'll be in space for years, you know. But we want to know whether you have a vocation, and we want to know it now.
Brother Joshua stammered for a moment, then shook his head.
I don't know.
Would you like half an hour? Would you like a glass of water?
You go so gray. I tell you, son, if you're to lead the flock, you'll have to be able to decide things here and now. You need to now.
Well, can you speak?
Domne, I'm not certain.
You can croak anyhow, eh? Are you going to submit to the yoke, son? Or aren't you broken yet? You'll be asked to be the ass he rides into Jerusalem. But it's a heavy load, and it'll break your back, because he's carrying the sins of the world.
I don't think I'm able.
Croak and wheeze. But you can growl, too, and that's well for the leader of the pack. Listen, none of us has been really able, but we've tried, and we've been tried. It tries you to destruction, but you're here for that. This order has had abbots of gold, abbots of cold, tough steel, abbots of corroded lead, and none of them was able, although some were abler than others, some saints even. The gold got battered, the steel got brittle and broke, and the corroded lead got stamped into ashes by heaven. Me? I've been lucky enough to be quicksilver. I spatter, but I run back together somehow. I feel another spattering coming on, though, brother, and I think it's for keeps this time. What are you made of, son? What's to be tried?
Puppy dog tails. I'm meat, and I'm scared, Reverend Father.
Steel screams when it's forged. It gasps when it's quenched. It creaks when it goes under load. I think even steel is scared, son. Take half an hour to think. A drink of water, a drink of wind. Totter off a while. If it makes you seasick, then prudently vomit. If it makes you terrified, scream. If it makes you anything, pray. But come into the church before Mass, and tell us what a monk is made of. The order is fissioning, and the part of us that goes into space goes forever. Are you called to be its shepherd, or are you not? Go and decide.
I guess there's no way out.
Of course there is. You have only to say I'm not called to it.
Then somebody else will be elected, that's all. But go, calm down, and then come to us in church with a yes or a no. That's where I'm going now. The abbot arose and nodded a dismissal. The darkness in the courtyard was nearly total. Only a thin sliver of light leaked from under the church doors. The faint luminosity of starlight was blurred by a dust haze. No hint of dawn had appeared in the east. Brother Joshua wandered in silence. Finally, he sat on a curbing that enclosed a bed of rose bushes. He put his chin in his hands and rolled a pebble around with his toe. The buildings of the abbey were dark and sleeping shadows. A faint slice of cantaloupe moon hung low in the south. The murmur of chanting came from the church. Ex cita Domine, potentiam tuam et veni ut salvos. Stir up thy might indeed, O Lord, and come to save us. That breath of prayer would go on and on, as long as there was breath to breathe it, even if the brethren thought it futile. But they couldn't know it to be futile, or could they? If Rome had any hope, why send the starship? Why, if they believed that prayers for peace on earth would ever be answered? Was not the starship an act of despair?
Retrahe me, Satanus et discede,
he thought.
The starship is an act of hope. Hope for man elsewhere. Peace somewhere. If not here and now, then someplace. Alpha Centauri's planet, maybe. Beta Hydri, or one of the sickly, straggling colonies on that planet of what's-its-name in Scorpius. Hope, and not futility, is sending the ship, thou foul seductor. It is a weary and dog-tired hope, maybe, a hope that says, shake the dust off your sandals and go preach Sodom to Gomorrah. But it is hope, or it wouldn't say go at all. It isn't hope for Earth, but hope for the soul and substance of man somewhere. With Lucifer hanging over, not sending the ship would be an act of presumption, as you, dirtiest one, tempted our Lord. If thou be the Son of God, cast thyself down from the pinnacle, for angels will bear thee up.
Too much hope for earth had led men to try to make it Eden, and of that they might well despair until the time toward the consumption of the world. Someone had opened the abbey doors. Monks were leaving quietly for their cells. Only a dim glow spilled from the doorway into the courtyard. The light was dim in the church. Joshua could see only a few candles and the dim red eye of the sanctuary lamp. The 26 of his brethren were just visible where they knelt, waiting. Someone closed the doors again, but not quite, for through a crack he could still see the red dot of the sanctuary lamp. Fire kindled in worship, burning in praise, burning gently in adoration, there in its red receptacle. Fire, loveliest of the four elements of the world, and yet an element too in hell. While it burned adoringly in the core of the temple, it had also scorched the life from a city, this night, and spewed its venom over the land. How strange of God to speak from a burning bush, and to make to man a symbol of heaven into a symbol of hell. He peered up again at the dusty stars of morning. Well, there would be no Edens found out there, they said. Yet there were men out there now, men who looked up to strange suns in stranger skies, gasped strange air, tilled strange earth. On worlds of frozen equatorial tundra, worlds of steaming Arctic jungle. A little like Earth, perhaps, enough like Earth so that man might live somehow by the same sweat of his brow. They were but a handful, these celestial colonists of Homo loquax nonumquam sapiens. A few harassed colonies of humanity that had had small help from Earth thus far, and now they might expect no help at all, there in their new non-Edens, even less like paradise than Earth had been. Fortunately for them, perhaps. The closer men came to perfecting for themselves a paradise, the more impatient they seemed to become with it, and with themselves as well. They made a garden of pleasure, and became progressively more miserable with it, as it grew in richness and power and beauty. For then, perhaps, it was easier for them to see that something was missing in the garden, some tree or shrub that would not grow. When the world was in darkness and wretchedness, it could believe in perfection and yearn for it. But when the world became bright with reason and riches, it began to sense the narrowness of the needle's eye, and that rankled for a world no longer willing to believe or yearn. Well, they were going to destroy it again, were they? This garden earth,
civilized and knowing, to be torn apart again, that man might hope again in wretched darkness. And yet the memorabilia was to go with the ship. Was it a curse?
Discede, seductor informis.
It was no curse, this knowledge, unless perverted by man, as fire had been this night.
Why do I have to leave, Lord?
He wondered.
Must I go? And what am I trying to decide, to go or to refuse to go?
But that was already decided. There had been a summons to that long ago.
Egrediamur tellure, then, for it was commanded by a vow I pledged, so I go. But to lay hands on me and call me a priest, to call me Abbas even, to set me to watch over the souls of my brethren, must Reverend Father insist on that? But he isn't insisting on that, he is only insisting on knowing whether God insists on that. But he is in such a terrible hurry. Is he really so sure of me as all that? To drop it on me this way, he must be more certain of me than I am of myself. Speak up, Destiny, speak up. Destiny always seems decades away, but suddenly it's not decades away, it's right now. But maybe Destiny is always right now, right here, right this very instant, maybe. Isn't it enough that he's sure of me? But no, that is not nearly enough. Got to be sure myself, somehow. In half an hour, less than half now. Audi me, Domine. Please, Lord. It's only one of your vipers of this generation, begging for something, begging to know, begging a sign, a portent, an omen. I've not enough time to decide.
He started nervously. Something slithering? He heard it as a quiet rustling in the dry leaves under the rose bushes behind him. It stopped, rustled, and slithered again. Would a sign from heaven slither? An omen or a portent might. The psalmist's negotium perambulans in tenebris might. A sidewinder might. A cricket, perhaps. It was only rustling. Brother Hegan had killed a sidewinder in the courtyard once, but now it slithered again, a slow dragging in the leaves. Would it be an appropriate sign if it slithered out and stung him in the backside? The sound of prayer came from the church again. Reminiscentur et convertentur ad Dominum universi fines terrae, et adorabunt in conspectu universae familiae gentium, quoniam Domini est regnum, et ipse dominabitur. Strange words for tonight. All the ends of the earth shall remember and turn unto the Lord. The slithering stopped suddenly. Was it right behind him? Really, Lord, a sign isn't absolutely essential. Really, I... Something nudged at his wrist. He shot upward with a yelp and leaped away from the rose bushes. He seized a loose rock and threw it into the bushes. The crash was louder than he had expected. He scratched at his beard and felt sheepish. He waited. Nothing emerged from the bushes. Nothing slithered. He tossed a pebble. It, too, rattled offensively in the darkness. He waited, but nothing stirred in the bushes.
Ask for an omen, then stone it when it comes. De essentia hominum.
A pink tongue of dawn was beginning to lick the stars from the sky. This book is continued at this point on the other side of this cassette. Please